Welcome to the podcast of the Student Christian Movement. SCM is a community of students, past and present, and it is community that is at the heart of who we are and how we do things. Based in the UK, our vision of SCM is as a generous community, expressing a lived faith in Jesus Christ where social action meets prayerful devotion. We seek to be both a radical voice for equality and justice, and a safe home for progressive Christian students. Hello and welcome back to the SCM podcast. Today I am thrilled to be joined by Laurie Brandt-Hale. Laurie, welcome to the podcast, and why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Well, thanks. Thanks so much for the invitation. I'm really delighted to be here. So I guess I can describe myself in a couple ways. I'm a professor of religion at Augsburg University in Minneapolis, Minnesota in the U.S. This is actually my 26th year teaching there, so I like it. It's been a good fit for me. In my work there, I teach a lot of undergraduates. I teach a lot of general education courses in the Department of Religion and Philosophy, and we introduce different religious traditions and talk about things like vocation in our gen ed courses. I also have been able over the years to, on a pretty regular basis, teach courses about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which is exciting to me, of course. I'm also the president of the International Bonhoeffer Society English Language Section. I just was elected to that position in November, but I've been on the board for over 20 years, and I'm excited about the work that we have in front of us. And I'll just start with a pitch right off the bat. We did launch a new website about a year and a half ago, and if you haven't had a chance to visit that, I would encourage you to do so. It's easy address, bonhoeffersociety.org.
Yeah, I can definitely attest to the fact that it is a great website. I linked it in the show notes on the episode with Jennifer McBride, and we'll do the same for this episode too. So if you're interested in looking at the resources on the website, then just have a look in the show notes. But Laurie, can you tell us where you first encountered Bonhoeffer and what drew you to his work? I mean, to have been involved with the International Bonhoeffer Society for so long and to be excited about teaching about him, just give us a little bit of background to that.
Sure. So I encountered Bonhoeffer initially as an undergraduate student in a survey class on 20th century theology. I was a double major in history and religion. And so I had this sort of brief introduction. I thought he was interesting, but I wasn't kind of hooked, I guess, as you might say. And then I had an opportunity to take, actually to sit in on a, there was a visiting professor who was doing a semester long course on Bonhoeffer when I was a senior as an undergraduate, but I was trying to finish up my majors. And so I audited the class and again, I was interested, but that wasn't it yet. I was interested though. I was writing on ideas of community. And so that was kind of happening at the same time that I was, again, encountering Bonhoeffer. I went off to do my master's degree and took another course on Bonhoeffer, thought it was interesting, but had not committed yet to, so I was slow to come to Bonhoeffer. When I finally started to work on my dissertation, I was continuing to work on ideas of community, and a number of people said, well, you need to read Bonhoeffer. And I said, well, I've read some Bonhoeffer. He's interesting, but I just hadn't connected the dots, and I also hadn't read his dissertation. And so finally, pretty reluctantly, actually, I read his dissertation. And then I was like, oh, okay, now I get it. And so then that was kind of a turning point for me. And so then I ended up writing my dissertation on Bonhoeffer. And that was the long, slow draw to Bonhoeffer. But I find his work so rich that I just have never stopped finding new things to write about and think about and talk about.
Can you talk maybe a little bit more about what in his dissertation helped to connect the dots there of the significance of community for Bonhoeffer and what you ended up writing in your dissertation?
Yes, so I think what was really drawn in by this notion that he posits in his dissertation, this idea of Christ existing as community, that the ongoing incarnation of Christ in the world happens in community. I was also interested in questions about, you know, what constitutes community. And so he was, he has a quite expansive definition of community. He doesn't put boundaries on that. But so at the same time, I'll try to make this a brief story. At the same time, I was thinking about his own very close relationships that he had. So he had very, very close personal friendships. He was writing about community. He was talking about the sociality of theology. But I come across a letter that he wrote when he was at the monastery in Et al. In 1940, when he was working on his ethics. So it was a Benedictine monastery. And he suggested that he had not been able to live up to the 23rd mandate, which is to greet each stranger as Christ. And I was really puzzled by that. I was like, well, how can this person who actually ended up giving his life for others through his political activism think that that's the case? And so I ended up exploring the sort of, I was trying to see if there were differences between intimate others, stranger others, and enemy others. Because he was also in the 1930s when he was in London writing very explicitly about loving one's enemies. So I found all of this very confusing. And so the title of my dissertation is Love Your Enemies? Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Question of the Other. And I was trying to sort of parse out, again, if you could make differences. And my conclusion was essentially that theologically and ontologically, there are no differences between intimate others, stranger others, and enemy others. Ethically, you can start to think about at least enemy others in ways that might be different than the other categories. But that's where I landed.
Yeah, and I think that's a great place to start with the conversation, because we're going to be talking about your chapter, The Interfaith Imperative, which is in the book Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Theology and Political Resistance. And I think when we're talking about interfaith, especially in the 21st century, a lot of us will live in very multicultural and diverse communities and the people that we encounter around us. So I think having that grounding of everything that you've just said there is an important starting point for what we're going to be talking about next. So when it comes to that chapter that I have just mentioned, when did you start thinking about this theme of interfaith action in relation to Bonhoeffer, and what inspired the chapter?
Yeah, so this is a case where my teaching context and my sort of research and scholarly work really were on two tracks that started to merge. And so Augsburg is a relatively small institution. Well, it depends on who you're talking to. It's a relatively small institution with about 2,500 traditionally aged undergraduate students. I think we're closer to 4,000 if you include our non-traditional students and our graduate programs and things like that. And it's a church-related institution connected to the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. And when I started teaching there, the student demographic resembled the upper Midwest of the U.S. It was primarily white, primarily Christian, heavily Lutheran, heavily Catholic, with a few students who sort of didn't identify as religious or had a different religious tradition. Over the years, with a lot of intentionality, we have recruited increasingly diverse students. We're also located in an urban neighborhood that is, as you said, multicultural in many, many ways that you can sort of define those, you know, different ways people would identify themselves. And so currently we now would describe ourselves as about over 60 and 70% BIPOC students, about 13% Muslim students, and so on. And so that has happened over time. So it's exciting and it's wonderful. And it's expansive understanding of community. And the department that I teach in, the institution itself, has been committed throughout my time there to pluralism and increasingly to interfaith work with deep ties to our sense of mission as an institution. And so, you know, in class, I'm introducing different world religious traditions. We're using pluralist frameworks. reading people like Diana Eck and Eboo Patel, who both, I use both of those folks in my chapter. And at the same time, I'm reading about Bonhoeffer and doing all this sort of Christological work and thinking about, you know, thinking about the ways that he does his own theology. And it just got to the point where it's like, I have to think about how these things meet, right? Where's the intersection here? Because for me, it seemed natural. Like there was, the resonance that I found with Bonhoeffer, the things that kept me coming back to Bonhoeffer, especially his work in the Letters and Papers from Prison, his really powerful and pretty well-known letter in July of 1944, when he talks about living completely in this world and the perplexities and the sufferings and the joys and the sorrows. For me, that spoke to everybody, not just Christians. That was something. And yet when you read a lot of his work, it's so exclusively Christian. And so I was wanting to sort of think about whether or not he was somebody I could read in a way that, you know, I was trying not to go in with specific answers. You know, I wasn't trying to create an answer that wasn't there, but I was trying to say, how can I continue to read him in a way that not only supports or maybe does more than support the kind of work I'm doing in my classrooms.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for that context. One of the concepts that you pull out of Bonhoeffer at the very start of the chapter, which you argue is key to understanding how Bonhoeffer relates to interfaith action, and you'll need to forgive my German here because the extent of it is Guten Tag, but Stellvertretung, is that correct?
Stellvertretung, yeah.
Yep, okay. Or another way you could put it is vicarious representative action. So what is meant by this and why is it important?
So this is a concept. So I'll start by saying that I think whether I or anyone is trying to make a case for interfaith work, or if you're just trying to understand Bonhoeffer in general, that this is a key concept in the whole of his work, that you really can't read Bonhoeffer without grappling with this idea. So Stellvertretung, as you mentioned, translated now in English as vicarious representative action, shows up first in his dissertation. It shows up in Sanctorum Communio, and he is describing it there really as a theological concept. And he's talking about Christ as the Stellvertreter, Christ's death and resurrection on behalf, done vicariously on behalf of humanity, is the first way he starts to talk about this concept. And then, so this has layers, because he keeps talking about it. So even in the Sanctum Communio, you get that understanding of Christ as the Stellvertreter, the one who acts vicariously on behalf of all humanity. You also get this set of questions about how we encounter others, that when you in the dissertation, that when you encounter another, the other places an ethical demand on you, you are called to respond. And this notion of community, Christ existing as community, which introduces this social aspect. So you have hints of the ethical coming in, you have a theological concept. What it means to be human is actually to be human, sort of being there for others, being in relationship with others. So you have an ontological component of the idea, and you have hints of the ethical, which then he continues to develop in, for example, in discipleship, and then again in the ethics, where he's saying that to be disciples, to follow after Christ, is actually to act in this way toward others, to act vicariously on behalf of others. And so this is this concept that is sort of threaded through, and you see it coming through discipleship and ethics in a way that he's talking about acting on behalf of neighbors. And that concept persists even into the Letters and Papers for Prison. And so on one hand, it's a key theological concept in Bonhoeffer. And then for me, in thinking about interfaith work, it's about thinking about interfaith neighbors. Again, when he's talking about responding to others, acting on behalf of others, he's not defining narrowly who that would include. It's a very broad concept. Yeah, it's not sort of relegated to people who share my confessional point of view.
That's great. And I think you've picked out one of the things that I particularly love about Bonhoeffer is that a lot of the themes that we see in his work develop and mature like throughout his work, and you see the same things come up again and again and again, but in new ways and in a new light. And I think it relates in a way to the next question of how his thought has continued to develop beyond his life in terms of the scholarly views that have developed and the ideas that have developed around him on issues that he would not have engaged with at his own time. Like, as you acknowledge, Bonhoeffer was not an interfaith activist. So what aspects of Bonhoeffer's own thought makes you confident that this approach of somehow being in dialogue with Bonhoeffer on contemporary issues is right or even like possible in the first place?
So let me, this is a great question. Let me answer this in a few different ways. So I think the first issue you're raising is just this question of how does one responsibly do constructive work when reading Bonhoeffer? I think it's a really great question. And it's one that, again, I'll just mention first, I'll mention this, the Bonhoeffer Society. The Bonhoeffer Society is committed to this kind of constructive work. So continuing to do historical critical readings, but constructive readings alongside engaged pedagogy and sort of putting theology into action and practice. And so you have to take care when you're doing this kind of constructive work that it is reading alongside Bonhoeffer. I mean, you could talk Bonhoeffer, any other thinker for that matter, so that you're paying attention and being mindful of what they have, the work that they have done. At the same time, you're putting them in conversation with new questions that they did not themselves address or encounter. So it's not speculation. You're not trying to speculate about what, I'm not trying to speculate what Bonhoeffer might have said. I'm also not trying to sort of mold him into a particular way of thinking that just lines up with what I have to do. So you have to be really careful in doing that work. I was part of a webinar yesterday with Project Bonhoeffer from the UK that has a connection with your organization. And so John DeGruchy, Professor John DeGruchy from South Africa, who's one of the giants in the Bonhoeffer scholarship, was speaking, and I was asked to respond. It was a really lovely conversation. But one of the things that he said that struck me on this question, right, on sort of this, because he talks a lot about being in conversation with Bonhoeffer. And so he really talks about this as a dialogue, that you're taking what Bonhoeffer has to say, and then, but you're also providing something new, right? That you're bringing in your own context and doing that in a way that then allows him to speak back to you from his sort of his words of wisdom. And so I tried to do that in this chapter. Again, I tried to think about the ways that Bonhoeffer had something to offer me as I was, you know, starting to wonder about, or continuing to wonder about how to engage in this interfaith work in a way that that I do think is necessary. And so, but it's, you know, there is a fine line between doing that kind of constructive reading alongside with, without trying to just make him insist to say what you want him to say. I mean, we can make the same kind of arguments with doing biblical studies, right? So people like to proof text and make the case that they want to make. So.
Yeah, and I think like it's an important conversation to have about being in conversation with and respecting. And it's also just being aware of the fact that like for many of us, part of the tragedy of Bonhoeffer's life is how it was cut short of the ideas of, as you said at an earlier point in this conversation, how rich his writing and his theological work is, like the thought of what could have came after the war if he was to survive it, and for him to be executed in such a short time before the war actually ended is a tragedy. And continuing that conversation and basing that those ideas on the principles that we find in his work is an important work, I find. It's a relevant work for today. And I think a really good counterexample of where people potentially misuse it would be someone like Paul Jennings Hill. So Paul Jennings Hill was, I believe he was in Florida, and he was an extremist who basically had murdered an abortion provider, a doctor who was providing abortions, and his justification for it was pointing to the life and example of Bonhoeffer being involved in the conspiracy to try and kill Hitler, which obviously if you read Ethics, you would go that is not something that Bonhoeffer would justify at all. And I think that's why it's important to bring up this point in the conversation.
That's right. And so he, what Bonhoeffer is not, is he is not a template. He's not a template that you can just sort of take the choices that he made and the actions that he took and plop them into some other context. You have to do the work, the reading. And so I appreciate you asking that question. And like I said, I think the chapter that we're talking about is in this book that includes a whole section of constructive readings, where I think everybody has done a really careful job of doing that kind of deep dive into what he has to say, and then thinking about creatively and constructively how that can speak to our own context that's different than.
Definitely. And you state that the aims of the chapter are to demonstrate that interfaith cooperation is necessary in our 21st century context, and to show that Bonhoeffer compels us to reach that conclusion. So why is interfaith cooperation necessary, and how does Bonhoeffer help us reach that conclusion?
Yeah, this is like right at the heart of the whole thing, you know. I think part of this also came out of, again, if I take my own context, if I take the global context seriously, in the last few years, the rise of nationalisms, the rise of absolute claims to truth, that other people, right? So it takes people who have different points of view, different social identities, different religious identities, and makes them other in a way that is dehumanizing. I think we have to speak out. We have to take action. We have to think about the ways that we are human communities, and that the things that we share in common far outweigh the things that keep us apart or that divide us. And that difference actually isn't bad. Difference can be celebrated and lifted up. So I just think I mentioned in the chapter, this was coming, you know, I was writing this during the Trump administration, where there were Muslim bans and all sorts of other things. It's subtle. You have to go to some footnotes to find a few of those references, because I think it's more universal than just those specific things. But certainly that was driving my concern that we do need to. We need to embrace one another. And so that includes across religious difference. And then Bonhoeffer, I think, you know, really helps us, again, all of these things I was talking about, the Stellvertretung, about his understanding of Stellvertretung is tied to his understanding of responsible action. His understanding of responsible action is tied to taking care of people in the real world and addressing their concrete needs, not trying to, in fact, his ethics, I mean, he kind of flips the whole understanding of ethics upside down, where he's not trying to articulate universal principles that are good in all times and places. He's trying to pay attention to what's happening right in front of him and right in front of us. And then giving us sort of resources for how we respond to real people in real need. And then I was just so struck when I went back, you know, you read things, time passes, you go back and read things again, and it hits you different when you're in a different place in your life, or contextually, or the world's in a different place. And so this fiction, he's writing fiction when he's in prison in Berlin toward the end of his life, you know, he's trying his hand at fiction, and it's understood to be pretty highly autobiographical. And so the line from what's called the Speech of the Major, where he says, "For me, the main issue for individuals and for peoples is whether or not they have learned to live with other human beings and peoples. That's more important to me than all their ideas, thoughts, and convictions." So just living together, he ends that speech by talking about that the fulfillment of history is whether people have been successful at living together. And so I take that at face value, and that's part of how I make the argument, that you tie that in with all of the theological and ethical work he's doing, with this just plea to be in community with one another, regardless of how we might think we're different.
Yeah, and it reminds me of his relatively famous quote that talks about the not just loving the idea of community, but loving the real community that's in front of us that we encounter and experience in our real lives. And I think that relates to what you were saying about the relevance of this conversation to the aspects of nationalism and some far right absolute claims that are being made by certain groups within society today, is that they have this idea of the way that either the American community is supposed to be or the community in the UK is supposed to be, as this white and kind of dominant people group, instead of embracing the community that they actually are and embracing the people that are actually in front of them. And I think that's very relevant to what we're talking about. So when it comes to that interfaith cooperation that you've been involved in, has it enriched or informed your own faith, and in what way?
Yes, absolutely. I was thinking about this question because I think, you know, something we were talking about a little bit earlier with Bonhoeffer, that you said that was one of the things that you like as I was talking, is that his own life has a lot of continuity, his own theology, his own, all the ways that he's thinking about things. There's a lot of continuity, but there's also a lot of development. And I guess I would describe my own faith journey in that same kind of way. So there's continuity from my youth through my early adult years, but there's also a lot of development. And so I cannot imagine now, you know, I've got all of, I would call what I would call interfaith friendships, interfaith colleagues. And I think every encounter I have with people who come from different backgrounds, with different spiritual practices and disciplines, with different life experiences, it just enriches and deepens my own way of thinking about how I live in the world and how I think about what matters the most to me. So it's personal. I mean, it's a personal development, and it's also kind of an ongoing, ongoing set of questions for me in terms of how I would articulate my own faith position.
That's great. Thank you so much. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast today. I've really enjoyed this conversation. If people are wanting to engage with your work in any way, where can they find you? Where's the best place to get your writing and work on Bonhoeffer?
Oh, sure. They can find me through the Bonhoeffer website. Actually, they can find my contact information there, or the Augsburg University website. And I'm on Instagram. So it's just my name, Facebook, those kind of places too. But yeah, if somebody, my email's easy, it's just hale@augsburg.edu. And that's a pretty public address. So I'd love to engage folks on my work for sure.
That's great. Well, thank you again for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.